Reason and reality, crossword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Okay, I'll begin this week's show by acknowledging the events in Paris last Friday. Since there may be some who are, for whatever reason, unaware, Paris was struck with a series of terrorist attacks that has left at least 129 people dead and several hundred wounded. And this was not some lone wolf attack. It seems pretty clear now that this was a well-organized, well-planned event, of which reports say that ISIS was behind it. And of course, ISIS, as always, is claiming responsibility for any attack that goes on. And this is on the heels of the deadly attack, also apparently by ISIS, in Lebanon. Before I provide context and nuance, I have to say these acts are deplorable, indefensible, and can in no way be excused. Those responsible should be brought to justice. Although I understand all the attackers but one have been killed, and there will be calls to apprehend those who aided in the planning of these attacks, as there should be. Okay, that said, I worry that in an effort to find the true conspirators, there will be the classic and predictable condemnation of all things Muslim. I confess, from what I've been hearing so far, there seems to have been little backlash to the local Muslim/Middle East community, although it's still early days, and actually most of the things I have heard have come out of the States. Go figure. I also worry that in an effort to lash out at those who claimed responsibility, ISIS, that they will make a bad situation even worse. The French president stated that this terrorist act was a declaration of war. And on this I have a few thoughts. First, France is one of the countries bombing ISIS in Syria and Iraq now. So the declaration of war was not this attack. In fact, France has been participating in airstrikes against ISIS for over a year. And again, I am not defending the attacks, as warranted, but the fact does remain. This was not the first deaths in the war, if I can put it that way. Based on Wikipedia, yes, I know, not the best source, but I think it is one that shows the least exaggeration, minimization, or bias. So that said, the number of dead mentioned there, and these are numbers that are actually from the spring of this year, have about 7,000 ISIS combatants killed and about 500 civilians. So the current number, at least in my head, is probably about double that. I would also like to remind people that I am in no way comparing the legitimacy of the deaths, as in military strikes on soldiers are not the same as terrorist attacks on civilians. My point is, we should not see this terrorist attack in a vacuum, that in many ways France should have been preparing for something like this. Maybe they were, and this is the one that slipped through. You often hear security types mention that we, the public, never know about the many attacks thwarted by the security agencies. On this day, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt on that one. This also brings up the idea of the sanitization of modern military involvement of the West. We think we can surgically strike and excise the malignancy of evil around the world. It's a soundbite on TV. A distant and abstract idea, but not for the people over there. They are reminded of death and destruction wrought by bombs every day that drop on them. We here, safe in our homes, we begin to think that we can act with impunity. Our actions are without consequence. Well, France learned Friday that there are consequences. And again, don't misinterpret what I'm saying. The people of France may accept this as the price to be paid to rid the world of ISIS. My point is, when the French president stated that this was a declaration of war, the people of France should be reminded war was declared over a year ago, with this being the first battle to take place on French soil. There's also the striking contrast to the coverage given the attack in Paris compared to the suicide bombers that struck Lebanon on Thursday, killing 43 and wounding over 200. I suspect for most of you, this is the first you've heard about the bombings in Lebanon. Where's the call for solidarity? It also was perpetrated by ISIS. And of course, ISIS was also involved in a bombing in Baghdad that killed 18 people and wounded 41, earlier on Friday. We see such a difference, I suspect, because there is an element of racism. But I think more the cause is that we, here at least, think about a terrorist attack in the Middle East as kind of, so what? It happens all the time. It's kind of like a car accident. We feel the disproportionate amount of sympathy because such things are not supposed to happen here. We live in the civilized world, not the Middle East. But let's return to Paris. ISIS is hoping for a massive overreaction to the attack by the French. They, in my opinion, are hoping the French send in ground forces and step up its attacks in Syria and Iraq. This will so easily support the ISIS narrative that Islam is under attack by the West, that the Crusaders have returned and hope to kill all Muslims and turn the Middle East into a vassal state, as it did in the past. First, as I've reiterated many times, I am not saying this view is correct or that ISIS has any legitimacy in its existence or its action. And secondly, I do suffer from shifting opinions on what should be done with ISIS. Personally, I have a very unusual reason for supporting the defeat of ISIS related to their destruction of humanity's history. But that's a discussion for another day. That said, there is a major problem in how you get rid of ISIS. It was obvious to almost everyone with even the slightest expertise in the subject that airstrikes alone were not going to destroy ISIS. In fact, we have seen that it has served to only partially slow down their growth. And that last bit's debatable. That said, the point of airstrikes was to assist local groups, largely comprising of about four, in their destruction of ISIS. Of the groups, there's the Iraqi army, which provided some of the stimulus to the growth of ISIS, both in creating the conditions that a local population that would see them as an improvement over Baghdad rule, and by abandoning large caches of weapons that helped supply ISIS with arms. To date, the Iraqis have barely been able to hold their own. Then you have the Kurds, who are seen as the most effective force to combat ISIS, a force that has now fought Turkey, as their internal politics has caused Turkey to end their truce with the Kurds and resume attacking them. And then you have the quote, Free Syrian Army, which is largely fictional. It's a term used to label a dozen, if not hundreds of separate groups, often competing factions. Of course, they are also fighting on two fronts, as the original aim of the Free Syrian Army was to topple the Assad regime. And in an irony on that last point, they're actually allies with Assad in their attempts to destroy ISIS. And this leads to the final and likely the most effective force that can defeat ISIS, and this is the Syrian regime. Now Assad should have been gone a long time ago, but with this splitting of forces, who do you attack? Assad, ISIS, the Kurds, the rebels, Turkey? Every force on the ground is fighting every other force on the ground, and then some. And now with Russia's increasing its involvement in Syria, largely to destroy the Free Syrian Army, and maybe to help with ISIS once that job is done, it seems the real winner in all this is Assad. I think with this latest attack, more pressure will be put on the stakeholders to support Assad as the best force on the ground who can defeat ISIS. The point being, if you are declaring war, as airstrikes were most definitely that declaration, France, the US, Canada, all of them, should have brought forth a complete plan from start to finish, a roadmap, if you will, to the destruction of ISIS and the aftermath of such an action, and not the half-assed band-aid approach that we've seen in Libya, Iraq, or Afghanistan. I've talked before in the show about my thoughts on intervention, but if you're going to do it right and prepare for the long haul. We see in Libya now what it's like to do half the job. They got rid of Gaddafi, but now Libya is split in two, well more than that, in a perpetual state of civil war with no prospects of resolution in the near future. And this leads into my last thought about what France might do. We saw with 9/11 how it transformed the US, how it made the American people afraid, how it led the US to strike out in blind rage. A rage that has led the U.S. into two of its longest wars in history, Afghanistan and Iraq, neither of which seem to have been anything like a win. Beyond the cost, unnecessary war, the large harm done to the U.S. psyche, the U.S. now is the closest thing we have to 1984, when they gladly, willingly gave up their freedoms in exchange for a police and surveillance state. This is the true power of terrorism. 9/11 turned the Americans into a nation fearful people who see conspiracy and terror threats at every turn. And that is what France is facing in the coming days. The point of terrorism is not the deaths it may inflict. In the grand scheme of things, more people die in car accidents on a Friday than did in these attacks. Now, the point of terrorism is to harm the population's state of mind, to make them cower in fear, lash out in rage, to act against their own interests, and by doing so, submit to the wishes of the perpetrator. I'm not telling the people of France what to do. I only hope they can keep a perspective on what happened and the true purpose of terrorists, to elicit an irrational response. Please, 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 the nation, the government, the people of France, do not succumb. Remain strong and rational. Irrespective of what you may ultimately do, think it through. Be cognizant of both the action and the results. And most importantly, resist the fear. Vive la Paris. Vive la France. We will return after this break. Hi, folks. Sorry to break in. I was sent this clip sort of last minute and thought it should be part of this segment. So before we head off to break, let's listen into this commentary broadcast on the project on 10 Network in Australia. 10 Network is kind of like the CTV down there. It has a great message about how ISIS is really weak and not the boogeyman it and others may claim it to be. So let's listen in.
ISIL's weak. I know it doesn't look like that right now, but it's the truth. And they don't want you to know it, which is why it's something we should talk about. When news broke that more than 130 people had been murdered in Paris, this is how ISIL responded.
A group of believers from the Soldiers of the Caliphate set out targeting the capital of prostitution and vice, the lead carrier of the cross in Europe, Paris.
And really, there's no doubt that this was an Islamist terrorist attack, probably executed under ISIL's flag. What we don't know yet is if the attack was planned, ordered, or funded by ISIL's leaders in Syria, because the problem is, this is what ISIL do. They take credit for any act of terrorism on Western soil so that they appear bigger and tougher than they actually are. They did the same thing last year with the shooting at Canada's Parliament and when a bloke ran around New York with a hatchet attacking people, and again with the Sydney siege.
There has been some suggestion that is an ISIS flag.
ISIL didn't control these guys. They were DIY terrorists who recruited themselves, but ISIL don't want you to know that. How do I know? Because ISIL told us they don't want you to know that in their monthly magazine. In October last year, they wrote this. It is important that the killing becomes attributed to patrons of the Islamic State who have obeyed its leadership. This can easily be done with anonymity. Otherwise, Crusader media makes such attacks appear to be random killings.
Every time an attack happens, and they do claim it, they're headline news around the world.
There's a reason ISIL want to appear so powerful, why they don't want to acknowledge that the land they control has been taken from weak enemies, that they're pinned down by airstrikes, or that just last weekend they lost a significant part of their territory.
They really don't have the capacity to hit back against the combat aircraft of the West.
ISIL don't want you to know they would quickly be crushed if they ever faced a proper army on a real battlefield. They want you to fear them. They want you to get angry. They want all of us to become hostile, and here's why. ISIL's strategy is to split the world into two camps. It's that black and white. Again, we know this because they told us. Last year, they declared there is no grey zone in this crusade against the Islamic State. The world has split into two encampments, one for the people of faith, the other for the people of disbelief, all in preparation for the final great war. They want to start World War III, a global war between Muslims and everyone else. That's what they want to create. They want societies like France and here in Australia to turn on each other.
We as a society, as a community, need to be very mindful of maintaining and protecting our social cohesion, our sense of harmony, and standing together.
They want countries like ours to reject their Muslims and vilify them.
We need to look at the teachings of the Quran. It is about killing and beheading the non-believers.
ISIL's leaders would be ecstatic to hear that since the atrocity in Paris, Muslims have reportedly been threatened and attacked in England, America, and here in Australia. Because this evil organisation has it in their heads that if they can make Muslims the enemy of the West, then Muslims in France and England and America and here in Australia will have nowhere to turn but to ISIL. That was exactly their strategy in Iraq. And now they want it to go global. saying that out loud, it's both dumbfounding in its stupidity and blood-curdling in its barbarity. We're all feeling a million raging emotions right now. I am angry at these terrorists. I'm sickened by the violence, and I'm crushed for the families that have been left behind. But you know what? I won't be manipulated. We all need to come together. I know how that sounds. I know it's a cliche, but it's also true, because it's exactly what ISIL doesn't want. So if you're a member of parliament or a has-been member of parliament preaching hate at a time when what we actually need is more love, you're helping ISIL. They have told us that. If you're a Muslim leader telling your community they have no place here, or a non-Muslim basically saying the same thing, you're helping ISIL. They have told us that. Or if you're just someone with a Facebook or Twitter account firing off misguided missives of hate, you're helping ISIL. They've told us that. And I'm pretty sure that right now, none of us wants to help these bastards.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, your one stop for rational thinking. And we're back. Well, I promised a show or three ago I would conclude my talk about radiation. And this time, I would cover nuclear radiation. So let's have at it. Now, to begin with, we need to understand the atom, which, as I'm sure most of you may know, is composed of two main parts and three main particles. At the heart of every atom is the nucleus. This is composed of at least one proton, a positively charged particle. In most cases, a neutron is also present in roughly equal numbers to the proton. Neutrons have no charge. Quick fact. Actually, the number of neutrons seems to increase the larger the atom becomes. When an atom has a different number of neutrons to protons, this is called an isotope. So a hydrogen atom with a 1-to-1 ratio, well, it's hydrogen. When you add a neutron, you get deuterium. And if you have a 1-to-3 ratio, that's called tritium. The nucleus is orbited by electrons. Again, usually the same number as the protons. And take the word orbit with a huge grain of salt. Electrons are a fundamental particle in the universe, i.e. there is nothing inside an electron, it just is. And as a fundamental particle, it lives in the quantum world. So scientists often say electrons are more of a field around the nucleus than a planet-type object orbiting like we witnessed in high school science class. What keeps the atom in part of the atom? Some of you may be asking. Well, on one level, you have the attraction of the positively charged nucleus. This is why it becomes harder and harder to strip electrons from an atom. The fewer the electrons, the greater the pull of the nucleus on the remaining electrons. So it's an attraction kind of like magnets. Positive attracts negative.
Why doesn't the electron smash into the nucleus, you might ask?
Well, this is where quantum mechanics rears its head. As the electron nears the nucleus, its potential energy decreases. It feels the pull of the nucleus stronger. But an atom on this level is kind of a closed system, meaning that in the end, all the energies must balance. So, the angular momentum, the kinetic energy moving the electron around the atom, increases. These forces, at least to you and me, balance out, and we think of an electron as orbiting the nucleus like a planet around the sun. Now, that said, in reality, electrons are quantum particles, a wave particle. That means it never really has a point in space, but more of a probability of being anywhere. That means that the electron can and does appear right in the middle of the nucleus. And in an instant, poof, it's somewhere else. But let's ignore quantum mechanics. It's way too hard. And let's just keep our nice sort of solar system model in mind. Now, some more of you may have flipped the electron question around, of it spiraling into the nucleus, and wonder, what keeps all those positive charged protons together in the nucleus? Should they not want to fly away from each other? And the short answer is yes. They do very much want to get away from their like charged companions. But another force is stronger, and that keeps the nucleus together. In fact, this force is so strong, it's only its residual power that actually keeps the nucleus together. Now the force I'm talking about is the strong nuclear force, like duh, which technically is not directly keeping the nucleus together. The strong nuclear force, which is the strongest of all the fundamental forces, actually keeps the protons or the neutrons themselves together. By that I mean, an electron is a fundamental particle, i.e. it's not made up of any other particles. Well, as it turns out, protons and neutrons are made up of other particles called quarks. Three to be specific. The strong nuclear force, or the strong interaction force, which is carried by another fundamental particle called the gluon. It binds the three quarks together in such a way that the farther from each other the quark gets, the stronger the force becomes. Think of it like a rubber band. This is also sometimes called the color force because, oh, what? What is the color force? Well, let's save that for another show. Just know it is a force kind of like gravity. That said, gluons move this color force between local quarks. Apparently, and again, a future show, this color force may be shared outside a particle, i.e. a proton. And this is carried by a fundamental particle called a pion. This external force is much weaker, by orders of magnitude, and usually is referred to as either the residual strong force or just the nuclear force. And it has a curious effect. Unlike gluons, which get stronger the farther away a quark is, the pion is more like a babysitter. Meaning, the closer two particles get, the pion force acts as sort of a repellent. But if they get too far apart, then it acts like an attractive. To the analogy, a babysitter wants a kid to be as far away as possible. Go play in your room, whatever. The more the kid bugs the babysitter, the more force the babysitter uses to repulse or get the kid to go somewhere else. That said, if the kid gets too far away, it's a little too quiet, the babysitter is attracted to the kid and will seek it out, just to make sure that they're not hurt or getting themselves into mischief. There's one other fundamental force at work on the atomic scale, and that is the weak nuclear force, or weak interaction force. Where the strong force deals with the color of a quark, the weak one works upon the flavor of the quark. Okay, I can hear you through the airwaves. I must be taking the piss out of you. Quarks have color? How can something that can't even be seen have a color? And on top of that, now I'm telling you that they also have flavors as well. Wait, don't hit the button. Well, no, they don't actually have color or flavors as we think of them. It seems that physicists not only have a sense of humor, but also kind of a lack of imagination. Or maybe it's a hyperactive imagination. The colors are not real colors, but states. And some physicists wanting to put a name just sort of said, why not blue? And blue it was. Similarly, flavors do not seem to be inspired by real flavors, as with colors, but hint to more like types. As in the flavors are top, bottom, up, down, charmed, strange. Of course strange. This whole topic is strange. Anyway, remember I said that the strong force had force carriers. These particles that move the force from one entity to another. Well, the weak force has two types as well. The W boson, which has a positive or negatively charged, and the Z boson, which is neutral. It's called weak force because it only operates in a very, 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 very small range. And by small, I mean about 1% of the diameter of a proton, which is itself about 0.001% of the diameter of an atom. While providing some background, I should point out that a neutron is one up quark and two down quarks, and a proton is one down quark and two up quarks. So when a neutrino, which carries a positive W boson, slams into a proton, well, first the neutrino becomes negatively charged, or is transformed into an electron. And one of the proton's quarks shifts from positively to neutrally charged, and whammo-bammo, a proton becomes a neutron. And an electron is created and speeds off into space. Often so is the newly converted proton. Oh yes, and for those of you who are wondering when I was going to start talking about nuclear radiation, well, bam, I just did. That speeding electron is beta radiation. Nuclear radiation comes in three forms, alpha, beta, and gamma. Radioactive decay, as the name implies, is when an atom decays from a higher atomic number to a lower one. Usually, but not always, a less volatile atom. This is why radioactive decay is associated with nuclear fission, the act of, quote, splitting an atom, and is almost never heard with regards to nuclear fusion, the amalgamation of an atom. I should also note now that nuclear decay has two basic categories, particle emission and photon emission. Beta decay is a particle emission type of radiation, obviously because it emits a particle, that high-powered electron. Beta decay can happen in one of two ways. One, as mentioned, you can have a proton become a neutron. That is simply called beta decay. That said, when the opposite happened, a neutron becomes a proton, this is called positron emission. Outside of sounding cooler, both types have about the same properties. And oh yes, the positron part, that is the emission, it's a proton. And thus the atom actually decays and does not accrete or grow, which would happen if you started adding protons to an atom. This type of radiation can be stopped by a sheet of aluminum or a wooden door. That said, although you are essentially placing your cells in a particle accelerator and having an electron shot at them, because their penetrative ability is so weak, they're relatively safe, providing the source is in something, almost anything, any type of sealed container. Really, only our skin would be at risk to something akin to a sunburn, which, to be fair, could turn into melanoma. But beyond that, unless you do something stupid like drink a strontium-90 milkshake, you'll be pretty safe. And having said that, if you did have a real milkshake anytime between 1945 and 1980, the time above-ground nuclear testing was going on, well, you likely do have some strontium-90 in your bones. Okay, so we've started in the middle, and I've just explained how beta decay works and beta radiation is created. Let us continue with the largest type of radiation, alpha particles. Again, like beta radiation, this is a particle type radiation. Actually, one could call it elemental radiation, in that the radiating particle is actually a helium atom. When an atom is unstable or struck by a stray neutron, remember those being emitted by beta radiation, fission can occur. Sometimes this means an atom, like uranium-236, will essentially split into strontium and xenon. Other times it means an atom simply sheds some of its protons, like when radium becomes radon. Yes, the gas in your basement that can give you cancer, and it's all thanks to alpha particles. That said, alpha particles are simultaneously the most powerful or deadly radiation, and the weakest and least dangerous. Because alpha particles are essentially helium atoms sans electrons, they can easily be blocked by a piece of paper or your skin. Their ability to penetrate is the weakest of the types of radiation we are talking about. That said, our skin only covers the outside of our body. Remember when nerds of my ilk remind people that skin is actually an organ of the body? Well, that becomes important now because although alpha particles cannot penetrate your skin, they can, however, penetrate our internal cells, our organs, and the like. So alpha particle radiation is only dangerous to us when we ingest or inhale it. That's why radon gas is so dangerous. We inhale the radon gas. The gas then decays while it's in our lungs. where we lack the protection of our skin. And radon decay is really a shower of deadly alpha particles. The particles have the most energy and are highly charged, so they can do a lot of damage to the body and, more importantly, our DNA. This is also why polonium is so dangerous. Polonium is an element that gives off a lot of alpha particles. It is 250,000 times more toxic than hydrogen cyanide. And remember, hydrogen cyanide is probably more commonly known as Zyklon B, the stuff Hitler used in the extermination camps. And I seem to have Godwinned by mentioning Hitler. So let's quickly move on and complete our radioactive roundup. We talked before about electromagnetic radiation and that photons with extreme amount of energies are called gamma rays. Well, as it turned out, gamma rays and gamma radiation are one and the same thing. That is why this type of radiation is also called photon emission radiation. One of the premises of nuclear power, be it for energy or weapons, is to produce a huge amount of energy from the least possible source. When an atom decays, as we've said so far, a particle is emitted, be that an electron or an alpha particle, as well as the fission particles, those smaller elements. But if you weighed the original mass to the mass of the product, you would find that some was lost, and that loss was matter. But again, as we all know, you cannot lose matter, but you can transform it. And in this case, the matter is transformed into energy in the form of those high energy photons, the famous E equals mc squared. And to give you an idea of how much energy that is, it was about 1 gram of matter that was converted in the nuclear bomb that hit Nagasaki. And that had the power of 21 kilotons. Wow. Now, gamma rays are sort of the opposite of alpha particles, in that they are the least deadly and the most hazardous. Why? Well, although gamma rays are the most powerful form of electromagnetic radiation, they're still pretty weak compared to the other forms of radiation. Let's compare the amount of energy each has. Beta particles have an energy level of 1 to 10 mega electron volts. Alpha particles, 3 to 7. And gamma rays, maybe 1. So gamma rays don't pack much of a punch. Therefore, exposure is not as deadly compared to the other types. That said, the likelihood of exposure to gamma rays is far, far, far more likely. What gamma rays lack in power, they more than make up in endurance. That is, both alpha and beta particles can be blocked or contained in, let's say, a tinfoil box. Gamma rays, on the other hand, can penetrate much, much farther. It requires inches of lead, a foot plus of concrete, a yard of dirt to block those little buggers. So you can safely carry your Brazil nuts, which have radium in the nuts, decays, gives off alpha particles, or bananas, potassium 40 in this fruit gives off beta particles, in a thermos. But you wouldn't need a thick safe to protect you from, okay, it's the banana again, seems like potassium 40 gives you double the radiation fun by also giving off gamma rays, but only a few. So it seems if you keep your mouth shut, and I guess other orifices, you need never really worry about the majority of radiation, i.e. alpha and beta particles. That said, although exposure will take some time to do any harm, and time is a very relative term here, years working in a nuclear power plant, a second juggling plutonium balls, what was I saying? Oh yes, gamma rays are not very powerful, but like zombies, they follow you wherever you go and will ultimately get you in the end. Unless, of course, you lock them up in a lead safe. Okay, I think we're done with this. Oh wait, I'm being told by Control Central that I missed some. These are not typical forms of radiation. And by typical, I mean the kind non-physicists ever talk about. Okay, first is neutron radiation. This is actually really important in maintaining a nuclear chain reaction. I mentioned that nuclear fission can happen when a stray neutron strikes an atom and breaks it apart. What I didn't mention is where these neutrons come from. Well, they are both the cause and result of fission. That when an atom splits, one product can be a neutron. Now, due to the high kinetic energy of neutrons, this radiation is considered to be the most severe and dangerous radiation to the whole body when it is exposed to an external radiation source. In comparison to conventional ionizing radiation based on photons or electrons, neutrons repeatedly bounce and absorb by light nucleus. So hydrogen-rich materials are actually more effective shielding than something like iron. The light atoms serve to slow down the neutron by elastically scattering so that they can be absorbed by a nuclear reaction. However, gamma radiation is often produced in such a reaction, so in some ways, it's a higher dose of radiation, and the absorption can be an ionizing effect. That is, neutron radiation is also ionizing radiation, i.e. it can cause cancer, or worse. Neutron radiation can be a useful tool. They are most commonly used for scattering or diffraction experiments in order to assess the properties of structures of material in crystallography, condensed matter physics, biology, solid chemistry, yada, yada, yada. Because neutrons are uncharged, they are more penetrating than alpha radiation or beta radiation, and they are used for imaging in industrial parts in a process termed neutron radiography for 2D images and tomography for 3D images. Neutron imaging is commonly used in the nuclear industry, space, aerospace industry, as well as the, quote, highly reliable explosive industry. Not sure what that is, but, you know. So, another type. There is also electron capture, which is essentially the same thing as beta decay, not caused by a pion, but an impacting electron. This is different in that, one, it absorbs the electron as opposed to emitting one, and two, that it actually emits something called an electron neutrino, which is, again, another segment, another day. There's also, apparently, bound state beta decay, where a free neutron or nucleus beta decays into an electron and an antineutrino, but where an electron is not emitted, as it is captured by an empty K-shell, and the daughter cell is left in an excited and unstable mood. Double beta decay, where a nucleus emits two electrons and two antineutrinos. Double electron capture, where a nucleus absorbs two orbital electrons and emits two neutrinos. Electron capture with positron emission, where a nucleus absorbs one orbital electron, emits one positron and two neutrinos. And lastly, for now, double positron emission, which obviously emits two positrons and two neutrinos. Yeah, kind of getting into the weeds on that last bit, but yeah, we got it covered. And I'm pretty much nerded out. So we're gonna take a bit of a break and we will return.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM, your anomalous source of skepticism. And we're back. This week on Radio Freethinker's Cryptid Corner is the Chupacabra. Now, unlike a number of cryptids, this one is relatively recent in its origin. And yes, unlike other cryptids, spoiler, this one ain't real. Chupacabra means goat sucker, and that is supposedly its main defining characteristic. It supposedly attacks and drinks the blood of chickens, goats, and other farm animals and pets. It's been reported all over the Americas, specifically though in the southwestern United States, Mexico, and Puerto Rico. Although few sightings are exactly alike, the chupacabras fall into two basic types. One is a bipedal reptilian of some form, and the other is a quadruped canid, or kind of like a dog. According to Cryptid Wiki, when it sucks blood, it also allegedly makes out sort of a weird noise. Also according to Cryptid Wiki, the first known attack took place on March of 1995 in Puerto Rico. where 8 sheep were discovered dead, each completely drained of blood. This was followed up with the first reported sighting of the cryptid by Madeline Talentino, a resident of the village of Canavanas, Puerto Rico. In the cryptid community, the drawing made from her description is seen as the most famous. Now, Cryptid Wiki claims that deaths attributed to the chupacabra exploded and spread across the southern U.S., Mexico, and into Central America. Of the apparent 1,000 plus deaths in 1995 alone, the one most characteristic that linked these together, again, according to the cryptid community, was that the animals had been drained of blood and one or more puncture wounds were present. It is curious, the most famous, and I guess that doesn't necessarily mean the most accurate, nonetheless, the most famous description of the chupacabra by Talentino, well, it looks nothing like the current accepted description. In fact, skeptic Ben Redford, author of the book Tracking the Chupacabra, The Vampire of Beasts in Fact, Fiction, and Folklore, believes that at least the description Talentino gives owes more to Hollywood than the cryptid. He points out that Talentino's account bore a resemblance to the character Syl in the 1995 movie Species, a resemblance confirmed by Talentino, who was interviewed by Radford. In that interview, Talentino stated that she had seen the film Species prior to her sighting of the creature, and that she believed that an experiment had been conducted in Puerto Rico and it had escaped, similar to the events depicted in the movie. According to Radford, Talentino believed the creatures and the events she saw in Species were actually happening in reality at the time in Puerto Rico, causing Redford to conclude that the movie Species may have provided the influence for the first reported chupacabra sighting in 1995. According to Redford, you can make a direct connection between the film hitting theaters, she seeing the creature in the film, seeing it in the streets, making the report, and it entering the public consciousness. That said, most cryptobiologists no longer think the bipedal reptile model is correct and now believe the chupacabra walks on all fours, has a long tail, bat-like ears, saber-like teeth, and is nearly hairless. There have been a large number of sightings of this kind of beast. There's photographic evidence as well. A quick YouTube search will provide you with some videos of the dog-like chupacabra. And there's a good reason for this. It relates to two things I just said, hairless and dog-like. A few times carcasses have been found. And yes, unlike most of the cryptids we've been talking about, this one has physicality, which under scrutiny turned out to be dogs, coyote, wolves, or a mix of these, who are all suffering from mange and often other parasites. Mange, I've discovered, is a skin disease of mammals caused by a parasite. It causes severe itching, which leads the animal to scratch itself to the point where there's hair loss and the formation of scabs and lesions. And with that, it would seem we have debunked or solved the chupacabra cryptid, that it is a Category 10 cryptid, be it the sci-fi inspired Talentino type, which I would state as a known to be false or faked cryptid, or maybe a misclassified known creature, which the canine type seems to be a misidentified sick dog. That might have been the end of the segment, except for some real outside the brain's thinking. One might remember that we said that Talentino thought the chupacabra was a real alien slash government conspiracy. Well, she's not alone. There's a thing called ABEs, anomalous biological entities. These are a popular classification in the UFO community. This community classifies chupacabra as ABEs and are convinced these critters are proofs that there's aliens on Earth. Not that they necessarily think chupacabras are aliens per se, but are an experiment they've done that's gone wrong. They also believe that there is a massive government and mass media conspiracy to keep the truth hidden from the people, probably to prevent panic or something. George Martin, a Puerto Rican journalist who describes himself as a leading UFO researcher, reports that it is being brought to his attention that the U.S. and Puerto Rican governments have captured two of the creatures. Martin cautions us not to exclude other reasonable possibilities. He said, quote,
"The apes can also be the product of a highly sophisticated genetic manipulation by human agencies. A Chinese-Russian scientist by the name of Zhan Kachin has produced genetic manipulations which have created new species of electronically crossed plants and animal organisms. Kachin developed an electronic system whereby he can pick up bioenergetic fields of the DNA of living organisms and transfer it electronically to other living organisms. By this means, he has created incredibly new breeds of ducks and chickens with physical characteristics of both species, goat rabbits, and a new breed of plant such as a corn wheat, peanut sunflower seed, and a cucumber watermelon. These are all produced by linking the genetic data of different living organisms contained in their bioenergetic fields by means of an ultra-high-frequency biological linking. If the Russians have created this technology, then without a doubt, the U.S. and other powers have too. Therefore, it's quite possible that chupacabra, or apes, could have been developed by humans.
Martin goes on to report that the chupacabra has been killed and blood tests have been done. Although nowhere do you actually get to see these things, but he then goes on and says,
the genetic analysis so far has revealed that the blood is in no way compatible with human blood or any other animal species known to science. The trace amount of magnesium, phosphorus, calcium, potassium are incompatible with those of normal human blood. They're very much too high. The albumin-globulin, or RG ratio, was also incompatible. The ratios found do not allow the results of the analysis to be compatible with those of any known animal species. At present, we can't place the sample with any earthly organism. Therefore, it could well be the product of a highly sophisticated genetic manipulation, an organism alien to our own environment or perhaps extraterrestrial.
Wow. Okay, that was a lot of sciencey sounding stuff that actually meant absolutely nothing. And that analysis will be saved probably for another show where we might take up apes. But for now, we'll return after this break.
She'll make a lovely doll after I finish with you. I told you your webs were useless.
Spider-Man! He's melting!
It's too hot. It's too hot. Something must have hit the control lever. Turn it off.
Want to save energy and keep yourself comfortable? Turn down your thermostat 1 degree Celsius or consider installing a programmable thermostat. If every household in BC with electric space heating turned down their heat by 1 degree for 8 hours a day, it would save enough electricity to power Science World for over 75 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker 101.9 FM, an enlightening way to spend an hour. So a few shows back, we talked about the Nobel Prizes, but we had failed to cover the really cool prizes, the Ig Nobel Prizes. So let's rectify that now. Now everyone was excited about the extremely egg-gauging egg experiment that I got no more egg puns. Why am I egg spending so much time on egg puns? Because a team of chemists did the impossible and unboiled a hard-boiled egg. Well, partly at least. How'd they do it? Did it involve time travel, the reversal of the laws of entropy? No. The team simply boiled an egg, and that caused its proteins to fold and refold into a messy, disordered form. I know, thinking of my morning eggs in terms of messy, disordered proteins does take something out of the enjoyment of breakfast. To unboil the egg, they used the mechanical energy of a Vortrex fluid device to change those proteins, causing them to spin at high rates of speed, which in turn caused the eggs to refold into their original raw transparent state. Now one might think this is silly. Why would we want to unboil an egg? Perhaps someone had committed an issue starting off making eggs with the idea of boiling an egg and then changed their mind. This technique could, at least in theory, allow them to, recover the cooked egg and return it to the fridge to enjoy another day. But beyond that use, what good was this science? Well, as it turns out, malformed or messy proteins is a major problem in the pharmaceutical industry. Proteins often misfold during manufacturing of drugs and are unusable. But if you found a way to refold them again, i.e. the unboil part, drug manufacturers could save time and money. Money that, at least in theory, could be used for more drug development. Although we all know they're going to pocket it, but, you know, the thought's there. Okay, from the egg to the chicken. It seems some inventive and curious biology was wondering what a dinosaur looked like when it was walking around. Then they remembered we still have dinosaurs around. The avian dinosaurs, i.e. birds. Of course, birds are only a fraction of the dinosaur clan. And weird, considering most dinosaurs had a tail. So they thought again, what if we took a common bird, let's say a chicken, and put a prosthetic tail on it? And they did that. Science was created. The experiment had researchers raising chicken from birth with fake tails. The idea was to see if their center of mass would shift, as has been theorized about bipedal dinos. And the results showed the birds did walk like a dino and lent support to the ideas we have about the behavior of our long-deceased prehistoric movie stars. Our next winner received an award for literature. What for? Huh? No, really, I mean, huh? As in H-U-H. A trio of language and cognitive academics found evidence that the expression, huh, or its equivalent, can be found in every human language. Apparently, this so-called repair iterator is used when someone hasn't heard clearly what another is saying. It had been presumed that huh was like a grunt or an emotional cry, not an actual word. Well, these researchers discovered, if you can call it that, huh meets the criteria for a word in the sense of being a conversational lexical sign which must be learnt. Although, to grunt well, that actually takes a lot of skill. As they so confusingly put it, thus, in contrast to what has been presumed for interjection in general or for huh in particular, we find that this term is linguistic in nature rather than being a mere grunt or non-lexical sound. Let's leap into the next Ig Nobel. This one's for management. The Ig Nobel categories are flexible and variable, unlike the Nobel Prizes. So, it seems what doesn't kill a CEO does not make them stronger, but more prone to engage in risky behavior. The researchers found that, quote, experiencing a natural disaster without, my emphasis, without extreme negative consequences appears to desensitize CEOs to the negative consequences of risk. They do not gain the wisdom to avoid danger, better strategies to survive risk. No, they just learned that there are little consequences for taking risk, making them riskier, not wiser or smarter. That said, and again, this seems obvious, but you only learn that common sense is science by doing the experiment. Anyway, it turns out, if you do suffer consequences, you tend to be more cautious in the future. In our case, and I shall quote again, if a CEO is exposed to extreme levels of fatal disaster and experienced a downside potential of risky situations, he or she appears to be more cautious in their approach to risk when at the helm of a firm. From the obvious to the counterintuitive, the Nobel Prize for Economics went to the Bangkok Metropolitan Police Force. It seems that if you pay a cop not to take bribes, well, they'll not take bribes. It seems a Bangkok traffic officer was about to give a ticket when a man offers him $100 or less than about $4 bribe. Instead of taking the bribe, he recorded the offer, then declined, and then arrested the individual. As an incentive to others, the officer in question received a 10,000 baht or about $370 reward for his honesty. That said, I suspect the officer in question was more offended by the cheapness of the bribe as opposed to upholding his duties. But I can be cynical on these things. The next award shows that cooties can be contagious, but in a good way. It seems researchers tested the efficacy of smooching as a treatment for allergies. It turns out by swapping spit that you can temporarily reduce the severity of allergic skin reactions. So if you break out in hives, ask someone for a snogging session. Oh, the things we do for science. Now, of course, one of the side effects of a good makeout session is the occasional pregnancy. Well, the winner of the Ig Nobel Prize for Math wanted to see if the claims of one Sultan Ismail of Morocco were true or just typical male exaggeration. I mean, he was given the nickname the Bloodthirsty, so you never know. The Sultan claimed to have sired more than 1,000 kids. In order to test the veracity of this claim, the winners of the prize created a computer sexualization, or sexual simulation. The promiscuous ruler, who reigned from 1672 to 1727, had 4 wives and 500 concubines. And if they had sex every day for his 32-year reign, yes, then his claim could be true. It is very likely he was the most prolific father in recorded history. One result I liked, and not mentioned much in the press, was not how many kids one dad could sire, but at what point is there just too many women? Historically, as previously mentioned, he had a harem of over 500. Well, according to several models these researchers ran, reproductively speaking, once you reached about 110 members to your harem, well, you've maxed out, shall we say, your output. Okay, from pleasure to pain. Everyone's complained at one time or another that potholes are killing us, or that they're so deep they hurt. The same for some with speed bumps. Well, as it turns out, some doctors in the UK thought, why, who knows? Well, they pondered if a bad ride in an ambulance could actually be used as a diagnostic tool. I suspect it's sleep deprivation that leads some doctors to such tangential thoughts. Anyway, they asked patients who were driven to the hospital if traveling over speed bumps caused them pain and to what degree. It seems that those who experienced pain while traversing the speed bumps were far more likely to be suffering from things like acute appendicitis. And that the sooner you know you have something like that, the greater your likelihood of survival. So it seemed a bumpy road may also be a great diagnostic. Who'd have thunk it? Okay, let's talk about our private parts. We've just talked about one use of these organs, procreation, but the winner of the Nobel Prize for Physics was focused on their other role, that of excretor of waste. Their research literally takes the piss. That is, they discovered that irrespective of size, the time it takes for a mouse to urinate is about the same, 21 seconds, as an elephant. It takes about the same amount of time to spend a penny, even though the bladder of an elephant holds about 18 liters of liquid, comparable to a cat's bladder that only holds about 5 milliliters. For those who are doing the math, that means an elephant has a capacity to evacuate 3,600 times that of a cat, or to reverse the flow, if you will. If the cat and the elephant had the same volume to void, it would take the elephant 21 hours to water the horse, if you get my meaning. While we're talking about the penis, what length, no entendre intended, would you go for science? The prize for physiology and entomology was awarded to two researchers, one who created a scale to measure pain from various insect stings, which of course is useful. The other one asks the salient question, does a bee sting hurt the same no matter where one is stung? So you have one researcher who basically stung themselves with every stinging insect in the world to create a relative pain scale. Then you have another researcher who I'm sure thought the first was a master of masochism and thought, how do I one-up that? So they proceeded to sting themselves on every possible part of their body, for science, to see which part of the body is most vulnerable to painful stings. To that end, the former scientist, I guess, stung himself on 25 different parts of his body. This included the forearm, lower back, the ear, calf, the foot, and then we go a little blue because he also tested his butt, his nipple, scrotum, and we end up with an X-rated sting on his penis shaft. Yes, he stung his... For those into that kind of thing, it seems the best place to be stung is the skull, the middle toe tip, or the upper arm, and the worst are, well, let's be open-minded and inclusive to our masochist listeners, the most painful places to be stung are the nostril, upper lip, and penis shaft. So sticking your into a hornet's nest seems to be the really kinky thing to do, I guess. And that's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Friday, November 20th at 7 p.m., come on down to Horse Records on East Hastings for Morning Coo's release party for her debut album, Baby Blue, featuring special performances by Tough Customer and Number 213. Tickets are by donation, with all proceeds going to the Downtown Eastside Women's Center. Check out Morning Coo on Facebook for more information.
What's so sad?
Oh, nothing, really.